You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Melody Fox right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and I'm flying solo again today as my co-host, psychologist Dr. Melody Fox, is on vacation. But that won't change the fact that each week we will bring you guests that can inspire, educate, and entertain while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. We will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and many great ways to keep your family mentally, physically, and spiritually sound. Now, having over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, I've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields who are working to make this world a better place for all of us. And we will keep bringing you some of these incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring you Answers for the Family. Now, today's topic is a topic that's very near and dear to my heart. For those of you that know me, you know that I've worked in this field. The topic is parental kidnapping. Now, I want to give you some statistics that sort of really kind of drive this point home. For instance, I mean, in 2010, the U.S. Department of Justice reported an average of 200,000 cases of parental kidnapping each year. And more than just the byproduct of a nasty custody dispute, parental kidnapping represents a form of child abuse that has sometimes resulted in the sale, abandonment, or even the death of children. Now, our guest today to talk about this compelling subject is Maureen DeBock. She is the author of Parental Kidnapping in America, a Historical and Cultural Analysis, which happens to be Maureen's second book. Her first book was Recovery of Internationally Abducted Children. Now, Maureen currently serves as a Virginia certified Supreme Court family mediator and is internationally accredited through IMI in The Hague in the Netherlands. She has worked internationally in conflict resolution programs, including peace building efforts in the Middle East. Her work in creating and promoting laws to protect children from access abuse, which includes legislative efforts, subject matter testimony, and the creation of PARENT, which is an acronym for Parents Advocating for Recovery Through Education by Networking Together. And unfortunately, when people say to Maureen, "You don't understand what I'm going through," they're wrong. Maureen experienced the abduction of her own child. Now, to tell us about this and more, Maureen, thank you so much for being here on Answers for the Family.
Hi, Alan, and thank you for inviting me. This is also a subject that's very close to my heart also.
Yeah, and I'm sure it is. I've had a chance to read the book, and I'm very, very thankful that you have written the book. Having worked in this field for quite some time, I've seen so much where people have these misconceptions of what this crime is, and of how it really affects people. So I think to start with, I mean, can you give us some of the specific, you know, characteristics or clues, you know, that a child may be at risk for international parental kidnapping?
Oh, yes. A lot of research has been done in the late 90s on this, but we have a lot of additional information now. And there tends to be specific characteristics that are present in families where there is a high likelihood for a child to be abducted. And when we talk about international child abduction, the research found that more than 90% of the abducted children came from bicultural homes. In other words, each parent was born in a different country. They were of different nationalities. That's pretty significant, over 90%. We find that the children are typically abducted when the relationship dissolves. As far as whether mothers or fathers abduct, more mothers do, but they tend to be very close still in the numbers. We find in abducting families particular characteristics, like the child is typically at the age of five or under. They tend to take them before they start school, but they will take them later. But the majority are about 5 years old. Male children as well as female children are equally taken. We find that the majority of abducting parents taking children to Islamic countries tend to be dads, while the majority of children taken to hate countries, particularly Europe and such, tend to be moms. We have a history of mental health problems with abductors, and they range from neurosis to severe psychosis, sociopaths. And this is an area that's been highly neglected. We find that the disputes typically center on cultural differences, intimate cultural practices, including religion. So those are just a few, but there's literally hundreds.
Well, yeah, and I think you're right on target. And I think that's one of the reasons why I thought this was such a great subject for us to talk about on the show. And for the parents out there listening, I mean, you know, we are such a melting pot here in the United States, and that we have people coming, you know, from all over the world. But at the same time, I mean, when people are coming here, they're falling in love. This is great. This is wonderful. We're having children. But how well do you know that person's background, and how well do you know that person's culture, and how does the culture they come from deal with things like custody? And I think that's where a lot of people are really making their mistakes, by not recognizing what the cultural norm is from where they're coming from. Would you agree?
You're absolutely right, because each culture, their family law codes reflect their culture, and it can be at odds with another culture. You have some cultures that fathers automatically get custody. You have other cultures where mothers tend to automatically get custody, and then you have cultures where everybody gets thrown into the ring and you duke it out, and the survivor wins the prize, which is the child. So when you have these—
I'm sorry, there was a noise that interrupted you, and I'm not sure what that was. I think it was something breaking in on our line, but go right ahead.
So we have cultural conflicts that tend to disenfranchise parties, especially when they go to court. And when intimate cultural practices are not understood, as you said, when parties marry, if you think they've had a problem trying to understand each other, when you try to bring it to court, it's even worse, because even if they do understand it, they're going to still look at a case based on their law codes, which are culturally evolved.
Well, and one of the things that I noticed in your book, and I really appreciated, is that you really went into the history of, of this crime and kind of how we got there. So, I mean, with this knowledge, I mean, what efforts have been made to prevent children from being abducted? How have our laws changed, and have they gotten that much better?
We are evolving slowly. I don't think the situation is getting better. For example, we do have what is called the Uniform Child Abduction Prevention Act, UCAPA, which has been adapted by many states. And this is usually an amendment to a state's family law code that requires the court to look at a set of factors that may or may not exist in a case to determine whether or not a child may be at risk for family abduction. We have wonderful programs that have evolved, like the State Department has issued the Passport Alert Program. We have the Persons of Interest list. The problem with this is even with all this effort, the number of abductions international abductions specifically continue to go up. And the reason is because we have this, while we're doing all this prevention work on one hand, the other hand is we increasingly have bicultural marriages each year. And of those, a high percent end up in divorce. Statistics show bicultural marriages are very difficult to maintain. And when individuals divorce, they tend to migrate back to where they have foundations and support systems. And this is where the abduction comes in. So this increase in bicultural marriages, and this also is a cultural evolution. You know, we now, it's acceptable. We marry across religious boundaries. We marry across ethnic and nationality boundaries. And so while we have prevention, we also have the social phenomenon of increased bicultural marriages.
Right. And if, I mean, I would say that, I mean, so much of that is good. I mean, it is good that people are, you know, are feeling more comfortable with, you know, with being able to, you know, to learn more about other cultures, to be able to learn more about other religions, to be able to have a sense of more than just a tolerance, but the fact that you can actually fall in love with someone, you know, that comes from a different culture. With all of that being good, how can we integrate that and keep it from being such a bad thing as it relates to the way in which some of these custody cases are handled?
Well, certainly, you know, our family law code being Eurocentric based doesn't really, it's not friendly to our multicultural families. And we are here in America extremely diverse. So I think the family law code in itself, although it's constantly being revised, doesn't really and never has really reflected the diversity of our families, and so the majority become disenfranchised. If we were to do more than become culturally savvy, or, and I don't like the word tolerant because I don't think it, I don't want somebody to tolerate me. I mean,
right.
we have words that in themselves really don't define what needs to be done. And what needs to be done is, I personally believe that professionals that are inserting themselves into family conflicts, whether they're from the legal standpoint or they're counselors or mediators, I believe that they would be more effective if they had intimate cultural knowledge. And I'll give an example. I'm a mediator. I believe in mediation. I love mediation. I do cross-border mediation, which is very different than traditional family mediation. It allows the parties to feel comfortable with their cultural practices, and they define problems differently and they solve them differently, but they can do it as long mm-hmm. as we don't impose these barriers from our Eurocentric cultures. I would like to see that done more. I would like to see this develop. It's still rather new out of The Hague and a lot of non-Hague countries. And you know what I'm talking about when I say Hague, the International Abduction Treaty. They're doing a lot of incredible work in this area, and it is proven to be successful.
Well, now you're correct. I'm very familiar with The Hague, but for our listeners who maybe aren't, go ahead and explain a little bit about what The Hague is and what its purpose is.
The Hague is an international treaty, the Hague Convention on the Civil Aspects of International Parental Kidnapping. And this international treaty, when ratified by a country, essentially recognizes a child's home state, and by state I mean country, so that if a child is wrongfully removed or retained from the United States to, say, the UK, as signatories to this treaty, they agree to return that child to the United States unless returning the child would place the child in some sort of intolerable situation. And this particular treaty, while parents litigate through this, they have a new arm that started development in 2006 on mediation. And the countries involved in the mediation aspect of this include non-Hague signatory countries such as Egypt, Jordan, India, Pakistan. And so it's new. I think this month they just released, The Hague just released their new protocols and ethics for mediators. So this is evolving. It's great I do a lot of this work in the Middle East, and it does work, by the way.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, because, you know, that's one of the issues that as somebody who has gone to some of these countries and returned the children, the concept of following the Hague sometimes becomes an issue, where you'll have a country that has signed on, but yet they're, you know, when you mentioned about, you know, provided that they're going into an environment, and I can recall a case one time to where the country, although they had signed the Hague, wouldn't release the children because they said that Los Angeles, because of its smog count and crime rate, was not considered a reasonably good environment for the child to stay in, you know, to go back to. So they were ruling that the child would stay in their country. Now, this was a Middle Eastern country it was a South American country, but it was a country that had, although had signed, didn't necessarily always choose to follow.
Right, and I think you're giving an example that is not uncommon of how different people or different cultures perceive problems differently. You know, people living in Los Angeles live with the smog and make jokes about it, but to others it might be a danger. But if you take that same, you mentioned Middle East, I'll give you an example, and I'm just so thrilled that you understand this background in depth, because I think you might appreciate how mediation can solve these cultural problems. I had a case where an Egyptian couple in the United States had broke up, and mom went back to Egypt with the child. Father notified me saying, I don't want to go through the courts. They don't understand my culture. I want my child back. And I said, well, you know, what is your agreement? Islamic marriage, you know, is there a mahar? What does she want? Blah, 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 blah. So I had to jump into that cultural mindset. And what I found out, and he was very upfront, was mom did not want to come back to the States. She didn't speak the language. She was an arranged marriage. She was back with her family. And she wanted to get divorced. Well, she can't get divorced without the permission of her husband. And she had met another guy, and dad wanted the child. So mom said, I'll give you the child back if you pay my mahar, which is like a dowry, $5,000, and get my divorce. And it sounds pretty easy, doesn't it?
Right.
The pride, now we get into our senses of honor codes. To me, this was an easy fix, but to dad, how dare her? So it took a year before he agreed that it was cheaper to pay the mahar, the dowry, and give her the divorce and get his child than it was to pay me to go over there.
Right.
And he did, and everybody lived happily ever after. But this is sometimes how these things go, and understanding that intimate cultural knowledge is what allows professionals, I think, to be to help our families in a more productive way.
Well, and that's, again, one of the reasons why I was so happy, you know, as I was reading your book and knowing that we were going to have you on the show, was to talk about just that, the international mediation, because that was so foreign, you know, 15 years ago. It was unheard of. I mean, it just didn't happen that we were aware of. And so there were so many clients that we were talking to that I think would have been a good candidate for that had there been some international format like you're talking about now from a mediation standpoint that would help them, but they weren't really getting that kind of international support. I agree. I mean, I think that especially, you know, in these situations, in the international cases, if there's any way that they can approach that, it's going to, in the long run, be better for the children, which actually brings me to my next question. And I think it's the most important question, you know, of this entire subject. And that is, let's talk about how these abductions affect the children.
Oh, my. And I know that you're very much into this. We know here in the United States through research that something like 800,000 American children suffer from a severe attachment disorder. And an attachment disorder can be any one of a number of behaviors diagnosed by a professional. but they stem from an interruption in the parent-child bond. And so a child may develop an attachment disorder if they lose a parent through any means, actually. It may be through death or divorce or abandonment or abduction. And so these attachment disorders are only the beginning of the iceberg. And it is well known. And in order to prevent this, we want to keep parents in children's lives. We know that if a parent denies the child access to the other parent, the child suffers the loss deeply. One abducted child described his experience saying, "I wasn't even allowed to use my real name. I was not allowed to speak of my past, and that included my mother, who I had to tell people was dead."
Mm-hmm.
Another young adult who had been abducted as a child described her experience saying, and I'm quoting, she described her experience as being scared, being betrayed by one of the most important people in your life, a one-way ticket to the loss of childhood, being forced to deny the past and create a fictitious one, and wondering how this could possibly be an act of love. Now, this is how children have described this.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's again why I'm so glad that that there is the aspect of mediation that you're talking about, because I too have spoken to some of the children and have gotten the feedback from them, and two come to mind. One in particular was a young boy whose father was blind, and the mother had stolen the child and had run off. And when I picked up the boy and I put him in the back of the car with the father, the first thing that he did was he started screaming, saying that he must be a ghost because mom said that he was dead. And so he thought that I had set him in a car with a ghost of his father. And fortunately, within a matter of 2 minutes, the father, being an incredibly caring and loving man, had, through hugging his child and explaining to him that he was not dead and that he has spent all this time looking for him, the boy quickly, realized that wasn't the case. But still, the trauma to this child, for that period of time in which, A, he thought his father was dead, and then to have to go through that thinking that he was now a ghost, it's just so unbelievable that, that a parent would put a child through that.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right, and I've heard of like cases before. I was involved in one that was very similar, and I think that, and this is my unqualified professional opinion, but we see this movement where the use of the term parental alienation and parental alienation syndrome, which is not a psychological diagnosis, is being thrown around by attorneys, it's being thrown around by parents. And what I see in the child abduction community is a parent diagnosing another parent's child that's been abducted. And they usually do this through forums. A parent will say, I haven't seen my child in 3 years. I finally got to send email. This child said they don't want to talk to me. And then another parent who doesn't even know them will say, well, that's because your child is parentally alienated. When we make diagnoses like this, it prevents that parent from seeking professional assistance. Because when we talk about attachment disorders, many of the behaviors that people talk about in parental alienation are also present in some of the other attachment disorders, fear of abandonment and this. And so my concern is that we have non-professionals who are diagnosing, and not only are they diagnosing, but they don't offer a follow-up. In other words, your child has been alienated, but they don't say what needs to be done because they don't know they're not professionals. When we work with families to reunite them, we have what's called a reunification program, and it does involve therapists and counselors and professionals to help the parent, both the left-behind parent, the abducting parent, and the child, to reunite in a healthy way. So I did want to get that in there. I'm very concerned about I call it flippant diagnosis.
Right. No, and I think that's a great point. You just touched on something else, which is when there has been a problem like this, how do you reconnect, you know, those families? In other words, if somebody has done something like this, and now they come back, you know, a year later or whatever and say, you know, okay, I screwed up. How do I have some form of relationship with the child? You know, let's talk a little bit about that. But you know what? Let's take a break right now. We're going to take about a minute break. And when we come back, let's talk about that situation where there has been a problem like this, but now one parent is coming back. How do we trust them? So let's leave that thought out there, and we will be right back in 1 minute.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shield specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
All right, we're back. We are talking with Maureen DeBack, and she is the author of Parental Kidnapping in America. And this is in her book, again, I'm reading it right now. It's a historical and cultural analysis of this particular problem. And as she has said earlier, unfortunately, it is a growing problem. So Maureen, when we went to break, we were talking a little bit about how do we reincorporate that? And is that something that mediation also takes an active part in?
I think it depends who the service providers are. Right now, we don't have any real regulations and no real professional oversight. So it's sort of all over the board. I've seen some really great practitioners. I've seen things that maybe I didn't agree with. I know for myself and some of the colleagues that I work with, reunification is something we address prior to reuniting the child and the parent. And it's part of that program getting ready. We prepare the left behind parent. One of the things that we've noticed is that they tend to grab that child, they hug, they kiss, I love you, and then out of their mouths will be a statement like, I never gave up, I've always searched for you, I've spent every penny, I have nothing, but I'd never give up. That kind of a dialogue. And we've got all this film from all these cases where we turn them over to psychiatrists to look at and psychologists. And the child would begin parenting the parent. They would begin being their emotional FAV. It's okay, mama, or it's okay, daddy. It's okay. It'll be all right. And that was the foundation of what their relationship would be. So we learned really early on that prior to reuniting them, to explain this dynamic to the parent. And even though the parent wanted the child to know how much they loved them, to refrain from that kind of dialogue because the child may internalize it as, well, it must be my fault. So that's an example of one of the things that we address prior to reunification and in the getting a parent ready for reunification. We also work with the child. And I won't get into all of that, but yes, it is a process, definitely. And then after they physically meet, definitely is a process. And then it depends on the child's age, how long they've been gone, their attitude, and specifically culture.
Right. Now, what would be something that you would suggest? In other words, I think most anybody listening, you know, that initial incredibly emotional response to of hugging them and making sure that they know that that they were loved throughout this whole time and that they were missed and all of this. I mean, to most people, that sounds like a pretty good response. So what would be something that could be done that would keep that that dynamic that you mentioned from the standpoint of the child now feeling like they have to start parenting the parent?
Right. Well, if the parent needs to step into that parenting role and they've already suffered trauma, and they have to remember that, that most of the left-behind parents are emotionally traumatized, they just want their baby. And usually it isn't that they don't, their child that was abducted will never return to them. They will get a child that is older, that has had experiences that have shaped their personalities and their ideas different. And so the first thing that I would tell parents is let the child give you clues and cues. This child had no say-so when they were taken. So in order to prevent the child from feeling like they've been re-abducted, giving his voice and giving the opportunity, take your cues. Some child may run into their parents' arms. Others may be standoffish. Certainly engage in dialogue. And again, I want to tell you very specific things, but again, it goes to age of the child. I can share my personal experience. I don't want to get into other cases because of privacy, but I was reunited with my daughter after nearly 18 years. She was a toddler when she was abducted. There was absolutely no communication of any kind. And she called me. By then, she was 20 years old. I flew to Syria, and we did have dialogue. But because she was grown, it was awkward. And she said, you know, Mom, instead of talking on the phone, can we go on the Internet and chat? And and we know that people that chat on the Internet feel more comfortable. They're not face-to-face.
Right.
And because she was older, and I don't know if this would work for teenagers, we began, before I physically went to see her, our conversation through Internet chat. It gave us a more comfortable feeling than being on the phone and having those long pauses. We also agreed that we wanted to use the initial time to get to know each other. So the questions were, what are your favorite color? How tall are you? You know, what are your dreams? You know, what's your favorite food? And it was like courting. I had to get to know who this person was. And we had our best behavior on. And it was not about me trying to vindicate, you know, myself or work out my marital failures or to vilify the father. None of that existed. But I also had the advantage of working in the industry for 20 years and knowing not to do that. When I did meet her, because she was a young woman, which was really odd, you know, in my mind, she's still two. Our activity, we wanted intimate activities. You want bonding activities. Well, how do you bond with a 20-year-old? And then it hit me. Oh, my God, let's just do girl things, you know. So we went and we had pedicures and went to the movies with me, that kind of thing. And it worked. It allowed us to do things at that age level and for me to realize she's a grown woman. And she was so lovely. It's 2 years now, and it's still progressing because I have to get to know somebody completely from scratch. That's my personal experience. This is not always a parent's experience. What I have found and what I truly believe is parents that immediately begin vindicating themselves and vilifying the father, the chances are that child, when they're old enough, will pull away from them. They want to get out of that conflict.
Exactly. And they don't want to be caught in the middle. And I think you bring up a great point. And I think what I got out of it and probably what much of the listeners got out of it is that it is so, you know, age appropriate, so to speak. I mean, it's, you know, you now have a 20-year-old, so you learn to treat her like a 20-year-old. You know, had she been, you know, 11, you would probably have to focus on things that would work with an 11-year-old. So, yeah, I agree. There's just so many different aspects that you have to take in. So, but it sounds like you now have a very positive and loving relationship, but more like a girlfriend relationship.
Well, she calls me Mom, and I love you, and she does all that thing. And we've been very candid with each other. We had to put an intimate spin on it. So I remember when I went over there, her father was actually waiting for me at the airport, and I had not spoken to him or seen him. There was all these pent-up emotions, and I didn't realize when I saw him at the airport to pick me up in Damascus, it just, this flood of emotion, I just didn't expect it. And he came up to me, and he put his arms around me, and he hugged me, and he said, "I'm sorry." Totally out of the blue. I totally wasn't emotionally prepared. My daughter was standing behind me, and out of my mouth came the same thing. There was this forgiveness. I don't know where it came from. Maybe so many years went by, we both felt a need. My daughter hugged me. She heard this, which I think was very good. And then he introduced me to his new wife, and she hugged me. And it was something out of, I don't know. But I had time to prepare for the meeting, too. I tell parents who are going to reunite with young children how to play with them. We, you know, show them pictures if they're a certain age, and have that time to let them show you who they are and what they want.
Yeah, I think that's great. And I know that, I mean, in some of the recoveries that we've done, one of the things that's been important is that we will try to bring a particular toy, a stuffed animal, something like that, you know, that was left behind, and bring that with us so that when we reach that child, and when they are now first connecting or reconnecting with this parent, that they're having something like that with them also that helps to make that connection to that time before they were taken.
I can't believe you said that. Do you know that I brought Nadia's baby blanket to her? I did the same thing. Oh my gosh. I think we're just so much on target here with the same sort of, but you've been doing this a long time too. So you've got it figured out.
Well, but I think, and again, as you said, you've been, you know, not only were you searching for a long time, but you started working with many, many families as well. So, you know, you were coming into this with a great deal of knowledge, and you know, probably as you are interviewing and working with other families, you're probably learning what works and what doesn't work. So,
yeah.
So it sounds like you were
I think I've been involved in about 1,500 cases now in one aspect or the other, whether it's mediation or I do a lot of expert witness testimony, risk assessments, forensic evals for risk for courts. So, yeah, about 1,500 cases in the last 20 years. So, yeah, I kind of got my hands in it a little bit.
Now, can families hire you outside of going through the court? You know, in other words, if you have a family that's from another state, another country, one of the nice things about this show is by being on the internet, we've had people that have called in, you know, that are listening from, you know, from Malta or from India or from Australia or from different countries, you know, all over the world that have called in or have sent in questions or comments. So, you know, do you have, in essence, you know, clients that will contact you and bring you into their case over and above what you're doing for the Supreme Court?
Well, my Supreme Court is just my certification, and I work under those ethics and guidelines as well as the international. So that's my professional oversight. So all professionals have, you know, certain criteria they work under, like you do with being a detective. So that's what that is. My cases are all cross-border. In other words, I work all over the world. I just got back from Jordan, and I work within a cultural context. And typically, though, there are some rules in mediation. For example, I'll go just about anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But both parties, mom and dad both have to be willing to mediate. It is a voluntary process. It is also a confidential process, so that if I assist them in facilitating dialogue and they come to an agreement, or whether they don't come to an agreement and they move on to litigate, whatever was discussed during that period of time remains confidential. A court cannot subpoena me to divulge what was discussed. Mediation usually occurs prior to litigation, so that it doesn't hold up that process. So that if the parties do come to an agreement, I write it out. They submit it to their court. Usually it's multiple jurisdictions to be enforced by the judge. The tricky part about it is the enforceable language. It's got to be enforceable in multiple jurisdictions so that their desires have to fit the legal framework. Typically, I'm working with the United States or a Western country and Islamic family law, so I kind of know the nuances of what the wording I need for it to be enforceable in both jurisdictions.
Okay. Now, and that's good. I wanted to make sure that the listeners understood that just because, you know, your certification, is in one particular, it comes out of a Supreme Court thing, it doesn't mean that there's a family in California and there's a child that's been taken to Egypt, that you can't get both courts to somehow see, that there is a way to mediate this and come to a reasonable agreement. So that's good. I mean, it's good that people understand that there is a way to get them all to see the same picture.
And it's important, too. I want to interject in here that cross-border mediation is a specialty. The American Bar Association Center on Children and the Law released research findings that stated that traditional family mediation was not appropriate in these cases. So simply being a family mediator did not qualify someone to assist in cross-border cases. So I think it's important for the listeners to know that while I may be Supreme Court and internationally certified, my education required that I also be certified in interfaith conflict resolution. I'm a crisis negotiator. I went to the University of Miami School of Law to get my advanced cross-border mediation with an emphasis on The Hague. So this is not something that is just, somebody pulled out of the air. We are seeing family mediators and attorneys attempting to mediate these cases without benefit of cross-border training. And I have to tell you, the results are so bad that when I went to a meeting with the State Department Office of Children's Issues, one of the first things that they said to me is, "Oh my God, have you seen what they're doing?" And they were talking specifically in cross-border cases. So it is still rather new for people who are interested in doing cross-border mediation. Understand that it's not traditional family mediation. You can go on the Hague Permanent Bureau website and learn more about it, ethics, criteria, all this kind of stuff for the professional that's offering the services.
Well, now let's talk a little bit about, not only about the book, but about how to get a hold of you. If somebody is out there listening and they're thinking, okay, this is exactly what I need, how can they get a hold of you, and how can they get the book, Parental Kidnapping in America?
The book is available worldwide online from all booksellers. You can also go to Amazon and download it from Kindle. You can get it directly from the publisher online, ordered online, international sales too, McFarland Publishers out of North Carolina.
Okay.
So you can pretty well get the book anywhere online. Your second question, I'm sorry, Alan.
Oh, just the best way to get a hold of you, the person that's out there going, where have you been? This is exactly what I need.
Well, I've been out there a long time. You can email me at MaureenDeVaughn@AOL.com. I'm on Facebook. I'm on LinkedIn. You can just Google the name. So there's a telephone number I can give you also that will lead into, and it's the number that we're doing the interview on. This phone line leads to the office, to the home, to the cell, So I can give you that if you want to put it online, or if you want me to tell you what it is on the air.
No, as long as I can put it out there, that's fine. I just didn't want to do that and then find out it was the wrong number. So let me give everybody that number. It is 434-658-3050. And I'm going to give everybody the spelling of Maureen's last name, because that might not be the easiest thing to Google, but it's M-A-U-R-E-E-N, and last name is D-A, B as in boy, A-G-H. That if you want to do that, or again, for those of you, if you're driving, you can always go to the answers 4 thefamilyblog.com, and we will have all of her information on our site as well. So now let's go into a little bit in regards to the history. One of the things that I like, and being somewhat of a history buff, is sort of the history of, in other words, how did families deal with these types of abductions, especially in the United States, you know, prior to any Hague Treaty or prior to some of the laws that have come out just within the last, you know, 30 or 40 years?
Well, long before the United States was ever an independent nation, they were already dealing with criminal kidnapping. And believe it or not, some of the first laws in the United States had to deal with criminal kidnapping. I know that a lot of it centered mostly around religious abductions, the Shakers and the Mormons, between England and the United States. In the United States, there was a law in 1817, and it was titled An Act Concerning the Shakers. and it was specific to those abductions across the waters. The State Department was involved in the 1800s. Scotland Yard was involved. We had a number of state criminal laws. So it was very active early on. Because it was difficult to get divorces in the 18th century in America, we saw what we call debt disclaimers in newspapers. And I believe in the book I have an example of that where there's an illustration of a mom with a baby or a little child, and the father is saying he's not going to be responsible for her debts, and she kept the child. I have others where the father does that and then offers a reward for the child. This is before child custody law gave mothers the right to have custody. Fathers always held presumed guardianship. And we still have these changes. I mean, we continually have laws that would blow your mind annually regarding abduction. In 2010 is the first time that I'm aware that the United States incorporated national defense with criminal abduction. And President Obama, in that Defense Authorization Act of 2010, required the U.S. military to respond to issues of international criminal kidnapping. So that was a little unusual.
Yeah, but I agree. But that was one of the I thought that was a very positive step for us. And again, for those, you know, if you get the chance, I highly recommend that you get the book because it really does take you through the history and the history of where, you know, there was a time in which, you know, men just dominated and got everything. You know, they just almost automatically won. And then you go through a period of time in our history to where there was a big shift and they felt that, that women should just almost automatically get it. And now we've gone much more into a more of a shared physical custody and a lot of other things. But there's so much that you can read in the book. But before we run out of time, we have some questions that have come in through instant message or through email from listeners. And I want to read one of them to you. This one says, my brother and his wife, parentheses, who is from a very wealthy family in Indonesia, separated 2 years ago. Before the divorce could be finalized, she left the country with their 8-year-old daughter. Despite all of his efforts, he has not been able to convince her to return to the United States with their child. He is currently heartbroken, but has found little or no recourse in the court system, and because of financial constraints, does not have the funds to pursue it. What do you recommend in his situation or other situations like these?
What I would recommend is it sounds as if he wants her to return to the United States and she doesn't want to return to the United States. And it sounds to me if they could both come together and determine what they could do so that both could see the child, but at the same time reside where they want, it might be the best solution for both.
Yeah, and I think you're right. I think this kind of goes right into what it is that you were talking about. I mean, from the standpoint of mediation, that, you know, until recently, you know, it's not been something that I guess was as accessible to most people. So and this sounds like one of those situations to where international mediation would certainly be an asset. And real quickly, one more question. It says a friend of a friend whose ex-husband was charged numerous times with spousal abuse and he has just won custody of their son because his family is very influential in their small community. He seems to have an advantage in the courts. She has stated to my friend that she feels her ex will absolutely take his anger issues out on the child, if not physically, emotionally, and that perhaps she would be best to disappear with her son. Wouldn't she be prosecuted for kidnapping if she does this?
Wow. Okay, that's a long one. First of all, abuse exists in every single case of parental kidnapping without
right.
Okay, because just the act of abducting is abuse. When we talk about a spouse alleging abuse against the other, that is very culturally based. And this is one reason we have a difficult time charging people with abuse or finding that there's abuse. I'll give you an example. With our bicultural families today, we have things that have been practices brought to the United States, such as female castration or circumcision, I'm sorry. We have things called breast ironing and gavage and honor killings and forced marriage that are in our culture as a direct result of these cultural marriages. They're against the law in the United States, but some of these practices may not be illegal abroad. That is a very exaggerated example of how people define abuse differently. Certainly here in the United States, we've had fathers have their children taken away from them because they rolled their eyes at the woman and she felt that this was an act of abuse because it went to her self-esteem. And we can argue this all day long. So, but the point I'm trying to make is abuse may or may not be defined by the law, and in very tragic cases, we do know that the criminal law, International Parental Kidnapping Crime Act, as well as most of the state custodial interference laws, provides an affirmative defense for parental abduction if one is fleeing the incidents of abuse. So I would highly suggest that anybody contemplating taking a child or something like that, talk to law enforcement, talk to your attorney, find out what your rights are for protection. Certainly no one deserves to be abused, and no one deserves to be forced into a situation where they don't have protections.
Well, and would this be someone that should be maybe referred to contact you to maybe see what their options may be?
You know, mediating cases of where there's abuse is a very, very tricky sort of thing, you know.
Right.
And I'm very careful with that. I really have to listen to what the dynamics are in the case to say whether I would personally even be involved. But certainly I'm open to anyone contacting me and discussing, you know, maybe what their options are, or, you know, in a non-aggressive, non-hostile way. Because I do think it's best for families to know that they do have options other than these really drastic, desperate, is what I call them, these desperate attempts.
Right. Well, Maureen, thank you so much for coming on. I cannot believe it, but we are out of time. But again, I really appreciate what you're doing out there. I appreciate the fact that you have put a book out there that I think will be very, very helpful to people. So again, in regards to this person with the last question, feel free to contact Maureen or to go to our website. That's Answers, the numeral for thefamilyblog.com. And everybody, please have a wonderful and safe week. And I hope you will be listening to us again next week. Again, Maureen, thank you so much.
And thank you, Alan.
All right. Bye now.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Melody Fox, right here on LA Talk Radio.